Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au. This tool is specifically designed to help you access practitioners who truly understand masking and camouflaging, ensuring that you get value for your money after the long wait times and investment involved in assessments. So go over to the website, grab a resource, and support your journey. Hello and welcome back to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today I have Claire Britton with me. The episode today is on evidence-based strategies for ADHD. And this is Claire's second episode. I'm going to put the first episode into the show notes. The first episode was on executive function, and it was one of our most downloaded episodes. Claire is a neurodivergent OT who works with neurodivergent people right from babies to retirement. She's a wife and mum to two boys living in Perth, and she is the director and senior OT of Neuro Inclusion, which is based in Perth but services all over the world. And she also runs the Neurodivergent OT on Instagram, which I'll drop down into the links on the show notes below. And we are going to do evidence-based strategies today. So, yeah. Claire, what is an evidence-based strategy?
So basically everything that's evidence-based is quite controversial. We know that in the past, the research has been predominantly on white men and young boys because that's who got the diagnosis. So in order to have the best quality research, the research needs to be a collection of long-term studies over a long period of time. But for us females, diagnosis of ADHD is relatively new. So therefore, the research that we're trying to utilize to understand the best practice and access the best therapies is tricky. So basically, there's no hard and fast rule, which is not what we like to hear. We like definite answers. We like concrete thinking. So what's happened is in October of 2022, the Australasian ADHD Professionals Association created the very first Australian evidence-based clinical guidelines for ADHD. So basically, this is a big document. It's 202 pages long with a collective of different professionals that work within the ADHD space to create a guideline that every single person that works with someone who has ADHD has to at least be aware of. There's a friendly version, which I recommend parents and teachers access, whereas the clinical guidelines is more for the therapists, the psychiatrists, and psychologists. So one of the ways that it has worded evidence-based practice is around the shoulds and the coulds. So could being like, we don't have enough research yet, so it could be helpful, versus the shoulds, there's enough evidence and research to back it. So we should be recommending this. So to answer your question, I'm going to answer with the should. We should be providing education and support around the lifestyle factors of ADHD. So things like diet, sleep, exercise, movement, they are part of the should and they are part of the evidence-based practice that any health professional that works within ADHD space should be providing. And so they're kind of our main go-tos. Medication is the other massive one. So that is gold standard. And in this guideline, it actually spells out the order in which medication should be prescribed based on the person's age and their risk factors, as well as other factors such as like genetics and co-occurring conditions and things like that. So medication, CBT, parent coaching, lifestyle factors, they are our gold standard should. So anyone with an ADHD diagnosis, if this is the first time you're hearing about this, that means we really want to be accessing more therapy and more support to gain either some information around those strategies and approaches because they are evidence-based. There is proven long-term research that this is the best strategy or ADHDers, And it takes a lot to get to that point, which is why there's not many other strategies that are of that same caliber.
I love what you're saying. And I think ADHD being spoken about more is so great. I think there's so much lived experience being shared, which again is great. However, sometimes people have got multiple diagnoses and they're talking about ADHD, but actually they may be talking about other conditions that they're not necessarily disclosing. I saw someone the other day on Instagram, they were talking about ADHD, but they were actually listing like bipolar symptoms. And then I could see people underneath going, oh, I don't have all of that, so I don't have ADHD. I do find it frustrating. What are some non-evidence-based strategies that you see that are out there that don't really work?
So we know that applied behavior analysis was considered gold standard, should, back in the day. And it got quite popular, especially around autism. And we started to see that it kind of creeped into the ADHD space due to the common coexisting nature of ADHD and autism. And like you were saying, you know, it can be really hard to pull apart what a diagnosis is in isolation, especially with ADHD. We know it likes friends. It's very social and it connects with a lot of different types of neurodivergence. So often it's not one size fits all. So a lot of the time ADHDers were accessing applied behavior analysis. You know, if we reward a behavior enough, it's going to continue. If we punish a behavior, it's going to stop. We know that that doesn't actually work. The research didn't look deep enough in terms of it gave the behavior outcome, but it didn't actually change their mental health or their sense of self or their understanding of how they fit in this society. We have things like the early start Denver model, which is really popular, especially in early intervention, that really doesn't have the same effect or strengths-based approach. Even things like social thinking program, We Think Is, or Incredible Flexible You, Highway Hero, those sort of social skills programs that were actually really common maybe about 5-6 years ago. And they still are kind of hanging around because there's therapists that still find those approaches beneficial, but they are very much not neurodiversity affirming. So things like teaching people around making eye contact or, you know, sitting on your hand is a way to reduce your physical hyperactivity, that doesn't really work. And especially it's females with lived experience, you know, we have such personal experience of trying to hold in our hyperactivity. And we are so hyper aware of that internalized presentation and the assumption that that's anxiety or that's, you know, a mental health challenge that we deal with. But it actually is probably just because we utilized strategies that didn't work. But that on the surface they did, like our parents thought we were fine, our teachers thought we were fine.
So if we look at, like, for example, we talk about body doubling a lot and people will say, oh, if you need to do your tax return, can you body double it? Can you body double that? Can you body double this? Like, tell me more about how the body doubling actually helps you.
So body doubling is brand new. It's not in the guidelines. It's not in a lot of the research. It's currently being studied rather than being published. So basically it's the intentional co-regulation with another person where we share space to gain their presence that is very motivating and kind of holds us to it, like an accountability aspect. So often body doubling are quite popular for females, especially around going to the gym. We often have like a gym buddy and that's actually body doubling. So if you felt like I can go to the gym as long as I know that Brenda down the road is coming with me, you've body doubled and that actually works for you. And it's really surprising how often when I put it like that, people go, oh yeah, no, that's what I'm like. If I go into the work, for example, and work in the office, so much more efficient because there's people around me. If I'm at home, I'm going to clean the house. I'm going to do other things. My brain just scatters. That means that body doubling really works well for you. And what we're seeing at the moment now with technology and post-COVID is people are utilizing body doubling online. So often they'll say within communities of neurodivergent people, I need to do a life admin task that I hate. Often it's like a tax return, like you were saying, or like a Centrelink form or something horrible like that. It's no end point or gain or dopamine hit. And they'll say, I'm going to do this horrible, boring task at 8 o'clock. Is anyone else available? Let's jump on Zoom or whatever platform. And I just need you to do other stuff with me. So as an OT, I often do my household chores with my client. So it just creates an environment of, rather than sitting down talking through strategies.
Oh, that makes so much sense. actually. But you would only need to body double if it was something that you didn't enjoy, right? Because if it's something that you enjoy, then you're like, right to go. But it's more around not enjoying it. Because I just was thinking then, because my hubby has so much trouble doing anything on the computer. I love being on the computer and he wants to sit next to me, but he's so distracting and he wants to distract me constantly, but he like can't do it if I don't sit there with him. But I have a very strong feeling like you need to be away from me with all of your up and down, whatever it is that you're doing, your chats you want to have, you will do anything else but do what you need to do.
I'm the same. I can't body double with my husband and it's taken me so long to actually realize that. Like I'm too emotionally attached to him that he then feels worried. He's like, okay, if you're asking for help, that's something that's new for you. So that must mean that something's going on. And then he becomes quite like nervous around me. And then that co-regulation actually throws me. I can't focus on the boring laundry because I'm sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, he's worried about me. Now I'm talking to him about me being okay. And it comes from such a beautiful place, but I find body doubling does need to be someone with a point of distance. So whether that be a teacher, a stranger on the internet, someone that you work with, but you actually don't have any, you know, association with, because I don't really want to engage with you socially. I just need your presence to motivate me.
Oh, that's a great point. Because if you've got two ADHDers doing a job, body doubling, and then one of them goes, oh no, we need to go to the shops and buy this other thing first. The other person's like straight there. Oh yeah. Let's go do that first. And then you just actually completely derailed each other. That's a great point.
Yeah. Yeah. And often that the other people that say, oh, body doubling doesn't work with me. And I'm like, yeah, can let's talk about who we body doubled with. And most of the time it is either like a partner or a parent. And parents, we are not good body doubles. We cannot help but help our kids and accommodate and provide prompting and scaffolding. And that's not what body doubling is. That's a whole other strategy. Body doubling is just in the same space. You're doing different things, but you're sharing space. And that's actually part of a neurodivergent love language, that you can both do different tasks, but be in the same environment. And actually that's as good as bonding as if you were playing a board game together.
So much sense. I just flash back to my childhood so many times where it was like, I was happy for my mum to be ironing. I just wanted her to be in the same room, but not talk to me. Yes.
How do you articulate that as a kid? Like, it's really hard to articulate it. Parents are frustrated. Like, I'm trying to help you. And they're like, I don't want my help. So something like homework, kids hate doing their homework. Just having them do their homework in the kitchen, on the kitchen bench after a snack, one, that decreases the transition after a snack. But two, they're just in the same space. You can then utilize that time to do the dishes or any other like kitchen-based activity. Just sharing that space is actually providing so much more support than if you were sitting next to them, telling them to write each letter as they do it. That is actually really hard to regulate and to focus.
Yeah, it's a great point. You kind of set up the desk thinking that the kids are going to go in there, but you're right, my kids don't do that. They set themselves up, put all of their crap everywhere, all over the bench. And I'm like trying to make lunches, trying to do stuff. But yeah, that's their way of connecting after school, which I actually don't mind. But yeah, I did have a vision that they would be in the office or at the desk that I set up for them. No, they don't do that.
Yeah. And that's the neuronormative stuff, right? Like society says there's an office, there's like a study for a reason. They go in there, they're isolated. They should just be able to focus because they need no distractions. But actually being alone is very distracting because their brain can go anywhere and think about all these crazy things that potentially if you were present, they wouldn't have the ability to do.
Yeah, body doubling is so much more intricate than what I think we realize. What are some other strategies that you see work with clients?
So a big one is habit stacking. So this involves linking something that you do every single day without fail. So things like if you have toast for breakfast every single day, we want to match that with a new thing that we don't like doing or we have difficulty initiating. And then the other big one that is really, really crucial is just really understanding our own unique nervous system. So I do a lot of work with my clients around creating a dopamine menu. Do you know if you've heard of this?
Oh, wow.
Before?
No.
So it's basically like back in the day, we used to do like regulation strategies and we used to do like behavior support strategies and parenting plans. But But that's really not that fun. And it's often like associated with a document that gets saved onto a hard drive and no one references it. So what I actually do is think about it like a menu in terms of, if I was going to a restaurant, what are some things on a menu that would provide me with a dopamine hit? So what are things that I genuinely enjoy that fill my cup up? And creating a list of that that's easily accessible to not just me, but to my family, whether that be conversation topic that I can just chat about for hours on end, or a video game that I like, or an online shop that I just need some time to do. Creating like a dopamine menu is really effective because it creates a visual structure that prompts our brain to be like, okay, I know that I'm frustrated. I know that I'm not coping. I also can't add to this, but answer questions like, what will help? That's not helping me. Like, it's actually increasing my cognitive load that I'm already overloading. And we kind of grade this as well as with some of my kiddos. We just have pictures of them doing the activity rather than the words. And we're taking the literacy element out of it. We're taking the reading aspects out of it. But it just creates that structure of, I know that your nervous system is overloaded or is not coping. What can we do to regulate you? So whether that be from an OT perspective, we often link that with sensory needs. If you're working with a psychologist, it's more around emotional strategies. So it doesn't really matter what approach you've got and which angle you want to target. We just want to look at what activities you do in your day-to-day life that actually fill your cup up, and then create a list of that, which is often the opposite of what we do as families and as parents. And so a lot of the time when I sit down with clients and we talk about creating a dopamine menu, it's actually hard because they're like, I don't know what makes them happy. They're frustrated all the time. And the minute they wake up to the minute they go to bed, they're like, great, well, let's start there. Like, what 30-second activity do they like? And if there's nothing, that makes sense why they're so grumpy all the time and why they're having all these really intense behaviors of concern. Because if you don't have a life that's enjoyable, yeah, fair. I think everyone would be grumpy regardless of age.
Yeah, that's true. If everything you wanted to do, you weren't allowed to, weren't able to, didn't have time to, had no access to, when would you be happy? When would you be joyous? It's a great point.
Yeah, and I think what's really key as well with the dopamine menu, these are activities or things that can't be used as punishment or rewards. It's like looking at food and it's like looking at sleep. We would never punish someone by changing their sleep, but it's around having that understanding of my nervous system needs this. Just because it looks like from the outset it's sitting on the couch with a blanket over my head or my phone for 2 hours, that might seem quirky, weird, like different. But if you actually understand it from a nervous system perspective, my nervous system needs that 2 hours to be able to do a full day's worth of work. And if we're able to understand the why, suddenly like we can build self-compassion and we can understand how it's effective.
That's a great point. What if there was mums listening to this and they're thinking to themselves, well, that sounds really great, but that's not something I can implement, or whatever the reasons are behind that. There's always so many. What do you think some of the barriers are for an ADHD mum to actually start to implement some of this stuff?
I think the biggest barrier is sense of community. When we talk to other ADHDers and we realize how different they do things and how normal it is within our community and within our neurotype, it creates a lot of these beautiful aha moments like, oh, you do that too? Oh my gosh, I didn't know that everyone just ate whilst they were driving in the car because they've just seen the Maccas and that reminded them that they hadn't eaten all day. And so having that sense of community, which is something that's so beautiful about your podcast and your community on Facebook and things like that, that it kind of creates this environment that questions and challenges our neuronormative society, but also makes us aware of what's called internalized ableism. At the moment, we're really good at identifying, especially as females, our perfectionism. But what is perfectionism? It's actually ableism. We think about the perfect mom, but then we don't factor in, but we're disabled. So therefore, perfectionism is never going to be achievable for us in the same way as it is a neurotypical. It will look differently. Not that we won't be able to get there. It just looks differently and needs different accommodation. So as a result, it's internalized ableism. How often in your day do you go, oh, I should have done the washing. I should have done this. Because that's your internalized ableism. That's your perfectionism. And that is the barrier to implementing anything that actually helps align to being more successful as an ADHDer. Because in this amazing published document of clinical guidelines, the should is for therapy and for health professionals based on evidence and research. When we as neurodivergent people use should, it's based on societal expectations and what we've been raised to believe. But at the end of the day, we can't challenge the shoulds if we're not aware of them. And again, It can be quite confusing to realize how much of the should there are. Like, that is a really horrible feeling to be like, oh my gosh, every day I'm constantly telling myself, I should have done this, I should have done this, I should have done this, I should have done this. It sets us up for failure.
That's really interesting because I feel like a lot of women, myself included, I have so much compassion for other people and I would be the first to be like, oh, look, Claire, you're having a hard day. You need to go and do this. Don't worry about that. All good. But then when it comes to me, I'd be like, okay, well, that's fine for everybody else, but I will continue to flog myself until I have a clean house every day. And that kitchen should be cleaned properly because that's not okay. And I'm better than that. And I should be doing that.
100%. And I utilize this in my therapy. Again, it's not evidence-based by any means, apart from clinical and personal experience and exactly what you're saying there. So I met with five schools last Friday and we were talking about how do we support ADHDers in the school environment. And I said, the moment that you make an ADHD or a neurodivergent student feel like they're a problem, you're going backwards. That's not helpful. But the second you tell them or you support them to help someone else, their potential is significantly increased. So what we need to be doing is grabbing our year nines and year tens and saying to them, what would have worked for you in year seven? Because, you know, we can do that with our adults and we're much better at advocating and providing this kind of support. But I'm sure you agree the school environment and education environment full stop is very different. So utilizing an adult experience to educate on year seven's experience now is very different. But also it empowers those teenagers that are really struggling with that massive social skills jump to have a positive sense of, I bring something to this educational environment. I have a purpose. I go to this place and I help those year seven. I'm telling them how to help create a routine around their homework. They need the help with the homework, but no one needs to tell them that because they don't have that lens. And I think this is why a lot of therapists are identifying as neurodivergent, because we bring our lived experience, but also we feel much more comfortable when we help someone else. We know a lot of research, a lot of therapists are parents. We don't apply it to our kids. It's a whole different thing.
Oh, totally. And I love what you're saying because it's, you know, the research takes a long time to catch up because you're right, it takes a long time to create good research. But there's things that we see that aren't research-based science yet. So, for example, I see a lot of mums describe their daughters who end up being diagnosed autistic as the kids that have friends who are either in wheelchairs, autistic, or they have diabetes, they have some kind of health condition that they need to go to the sick bay a lot. And it seems to me like the people that like to go to sick bay and help others a lot of the time are autistic girls. And that's not science-based. That's just what I see. And it's so interesting that they take those positions on and then they probably end up being the neurodivergent OT, you know, the psychologist. That's where they end up being, or they end up in, you know, the vet areas, animal hospitals. But that ultra caring, nurturing, showing, leading side is very much, I completely agree with you, a neurodivergent trait.
Yeah. And it's amazing how, being a neurodivergent therapist myself, I learn so much from my neurodivergent clients, especially my adults, that I then apply to my kids. And so much of the work that I do, because it's across the lifespan, that lived experience provides that evidence base rather than just going off the research, just going off my personal experiences. Like, I have a 40-year-old ADHD at the moment that I'm working with, and her big goal at the moment is something I've never heard of. It's so exciting. And her goal is to unmask joy. She says, when I feel joy, I want to jump. I want to sing. I want to dance. I want to be really big with my movement. And she said, but I'm really conscious that that looks childish. It looks silly. People make fun of me. So that is my goal. I want to be able to move my body and feel comfortable and safe to feel joy as authentically as possible. And so our therapy is every session doing our dopamine menu and trying to gauge at what point we are unmasking and when we are noticing those shoulds and our own internal barriers around when I'm happy, I should just be smiling. I shouldn't be getting loud. I shouldn't be jumping around. I shouldn't be crashing on the floor because that most hyperactive, naughty society says that's not okay. And I think it's really exciting that they're the kinds of things that are happening out in space because for so long it was all around behaviors of concern, anger, and aggression. And we understood that, you know, neurodivergent people had a really tough time with emotional regulation. And emotional regulation is more than just anger. And so to be able to sit back and go, oh yeah, even with joy and excitement, how do you experience that? Because if you want to flap, if you want to jump, if you do want to run, what do you? Well, because I don't think that's appropriate. That's him who's watching. And realizing that's more that internalized ableism. It's really exciting and fascinating area. It's slowly happening now that we've got more autistic and ADHDers talking about their lived experience and feeling comfortable to share that. Because at the end of the day, that is, like I said, they're the case studies. And those case studies are what we based. We then did randomized control trials. And those randomized control trials built our systematic reviews. And those systematic reviews built the even better Bob Center research. So it all flows into each other, but I think the best place to start is having those honest conversations, even just like, how are you doing? I'm doing rubbish, because that opens a door for collective problem solving. It opens the door for just validating and listening and holding space for, yeah, sometimes it's just harder. That's okay. It doesn't necessarily mean we need support or more, you know, crisis management. Like, we just need to be heard sometimes. I mean, especially late diagnosed, we haven't been heard for years and years and years. Why this, you know, clinical research guidelines only came out in 2022. And what have we been doing before then?
Oh, totally. Oh, no, I totally agree. Because I think you would have this situation happen to you as well, where someone will say to me, you know, especially in the school holidays, what are you doing on Monday? And I'll be thinking to myself, well, I'm already doing something else on Saturday, so I'm probably not going to want to do something on Monday. So then I would, in the past, make up an excuse. Oh, I'm actually doing this on a Monday. But then later on, I would see that friend later on through the week and she'd say, how was that that you did on Monday? But it was a lie, right? And I have to keep track of my lies that I would tell my friends, which is super fucked up. And so now I've just ended up saying to them, oh, look, I'm doing something on Saturday, so I'm probably just going to be really tired on Monday. So let's just do something later through the week. And I'm like, why did I make that so hard in the past?
We held their judgment higher than our own mental health. Because
and they don't even care. That's what we should do. They don't even care. It's like, I don't even know what I was doing. I think I was just trying to come off normal, air quoting normal. Like, because I felt weird saying, I'm going to do something on Saturday, so I won't want to do something on Monday. And I thought that they would then, like, I wasn't, didn't have the confidence to say it. So now I just say social hangover, I'll probably be ready to hang out Thursday.
When you first do that, it feels really uncomfortable because it's new and changes. The first couple of times you do it, your body tenses, you feel uncomfortable. But you kind of like utilizing strategies if you can't push through that initial discomfort. Because sometimes it's not until you do something for the first time that you realize it weren't doing anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it might be daycare drop-off, for example. I don't know if it's my bar of soap. I see her when she drops the kid off and she wants to chat to me about how I am. If I step up this social interaction, that's actually okay because it's not like we've been a long-term friendship. I'm not going to lose much. So I'm going to start there and start planting that and my social interaction and social opportunity to be like, I'm actually having a really rubbish day. Nothing is going my way. I just keep walking. Like, I don't want her to respond. I don't want a strategy, but I just want to hear it in my own words and say it out loud and just validate that rather than I'm good because I always say I'm good, but how do I develop those skills otherwise?
It's funny though, because if someone says that to me and it's a social interaction, like a school pickup person that you don't know really well, they say, how are you? I just go, oh, like, you know, I might say something like, oh, hanging on by a thread, you know, because that's what I usually say, right? Because I usually am. And it's so funny because if you get a neurodivergent person, usually they'll come back with, oh my God, I know. Like, oh, I'm like, I'm not even hanging on by a thread. I'm half off the cliff. You know, they'll come back in deep and hard. But sometimes if I get a neurotypical person, they'll be like, oh, are you okay? And they'll get really weirded out and then like want to leave. And then yeah. I'm always like, oh, that was a neurotypical I just spoke to. And I don't actually know very many neurotypicals. So when I talk to one, I'm always like, oh, I think that was a neurotypical.
I love that. It's so cool. And I think it comes back to like neurodivergent like culture and being aware of it as a culture rather than as a deficit or a difference or a disability coming at it from ADHDers. We have the culture of being very dramatic. Totally. And we love it. Like, I'm sure like you wrote down some of the garbage that we say, it would sound like we are horrific people and we do horrific things and we do deserve X, Y, Z. But I think that's where like the double empathy problem in action is really important to understand. The dramatics are because I need to express it. And I need to express it with my words in a way that I feel is the right level of intensity because our emotions are so intense as neurodivergent people. So therefore the language I use is very intense. But often we hear, you know, oh, such and such said they hate me. You know, my kids said that they hate me today. All this kind of talk. What's actually happening is they're just trying to express that they are angry. They're frustrated with the situation. But if we're neurotypical, we take that from the face value of, oh my gosh, they hate me. But if you're neurodivergent, you understand that the language is just a means of expression and it is a way to provide that calming auditory input because especially being hyperactive internally, we're so used to that internal monologue constantly going. Sometimes when we say stuff out loud, we don't realize how it actually can be processed. We're so used to that internal monologue. So when we say it out loud, sometimes it's like, oh, that is a bit harsh. But that's what I've been telling myself for years. And now only just am starting to verbalize that out loud and starting to realize why people did go down the mental health route previously when I was a teenager. They were concerned about my anxiety levels. And it's fair, that's their point of reference. But for me, it was my ability to articulate and my communication style with more ADHD that I didn't have time to think about the nuance of the exact word, the exact tone, the exact delivery. I felt a certain way and I put it out in the universe. Now I've stuffed up the social interaction. Like, now I can understand that that's my neurodivergent culture and that's my preference rather than coming at it from a, oh my gosh, I'm so bad at social interaction.
Oh yeah, it is good though sometimes because I have a tendency to offend people. I'm aware of it. Most people know that. And I usually explain to someone when I'm like starting a new friendship with someone, like, I just want to let you know that I often accidentally offend people, but my intention is always good. But sometimes I'm so direct that I ask things that people find off-putting. And anyway, most of the time, by the time I've said it as a friend, they come back to me and go, oh, yes, I have noticed that about you. And I'm thinking, oh, so not only have I tried to jump in to let them know I may offend them in the future, I've already done that. And I don't know when. But they're still willing to be friends with me because they must realize that I don't mean it or I haven't meant it. And there's something about that, you know, ADHD culture around, well, I know that you didn't mean that. I've offended people before as well. And that's okay.
100%. And I think this is why a lot of the ADHDers, especially females, have a bit more difficulty with our social interactions and often have that co-occurring autism compared to our boys. Our boys don't have to do half the socializing at such a young age. They can just run and kick a ball in the oval and actually talk to each other and not be like appropriate. Like, oh yeah, he's got great friends. Like, yeah, you don't have no concerns with your social skills, but actually he is autistic. But because society says they can just run around and kick a ball and they don't have to talk about their deepest, darkest thoughts and feelings like, you know, young girls do. It's a difference in societal expectations. So therefore it looks different. But if we're utilizing that as how we're diagnosing and differentiating diagnoses, that's really complicated. So it's totally around like looking at what strategies work for one person, work for the next person, but also we just want a toolbox. We want a menu, whether that be your dopamine menu, whether that be a toolbox of emotional regulation strategies or sensory strategies, whatever it is, you just want a toolbox, because at any point in time, you need something. So it doesn't matter what the strategy is. It doesn't matter what the evidence base behind it is. We just want to start from a point of evidence base and informed choice and control to then be able to try what we should do. If that doesn't work for you, that's completely okay. The research is not 100% concrete for anybody. Why, when you're neurodiverse, we're all very different. Our nervous systems are different. So it's just around creating an environment that supports our nervous system and our ability to function.
That sounds like a great place to finish it off. Thank you so much for your time, Claire. I think that's really been great to go through what is evidence-based, what isn't, and what, you know, you see truly work. If you'd like to see more about Claire, I'm going to put all of her information in the show notes. I follow her on Instagram. I find her to be highly entertaining and highly informative. So if you'd like to follow lived experiences by someone with clinical experience, highly recommend Claire. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Dane. Like, pleasure.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.